Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 31st of January. Satellite data reveals that more than half the buildings in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed in Israel's war with Hamas. But what are the chances of a ceasefire there?
We will not withdraw the Israel Defense Forces from the Gaza Strip, and we will not release thousands of terrorists. None of this will happen.
Meanwhile, Israel's confirmed it is pumping seawater into tunnels in Gaza. The fragile governing coalition in Spain has suffered a setback as Parliament rejected an amnesty law for Catalan separatists. And have researchers solved the mystery of why insects are attracted to lights? Also in the podcast, Pakistan's main opposition party condemns a 10-year prison sentence given to its leader, Imran Khan. And...
let us take you with us to Solaris, planet of mystery.
Looking back at a century of Russia's main film studio, Mosfilm. The United Nations Security Council has expressed concern about what it calls the dire and rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in Gaza. It followed a closed-door briefing from the new Humanitarian and Reconstruction Coordinator for the territory. New analysis of satellite imagery has revealed the full extent of the destruction there, showing that more than half the buildings in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed in Israel's military offensive, which followed the Hamas massacre of the 7th of October. Caroline Hawley has the details.
Aid agencies have repeatedly warned of the scale of suffering and destruction in Gaza. Now, new satellite imagery reveals the true extent of it, with whole residential neighbourhoods in ruins, once bustling streets, now silent. The analysis estimates that between 50 to 61% of all buildings in the Gaza Strip have been badly damaged or destroyed. This includes 38,000 buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis alone. Corey Scher of City University of New York has analysed images from a range of war zones.
The extent and pace of damage is remarkable. I've never seen satellite radar indicated damage appear so quickly. And in that sense, it really stands out.
And it's not just buildings. BBC Verify has examined images which show large areas of farmland in the north and centre of Gaza laid waste. The IDF says Hamas tunnel entrances and rocket launch sites had been found in some agricultural areas, and it's repeatedly accused Hamas of embedding itself in built-up areas. But there have been allegations of deliberate destruction, including of a university blown up earlier this month in what appears to have been a controlled explosion after it had been used by Israel as a military base. The UN says 85% of Gaza's population has now been displaced by the war. Many people are now camped out close to the Egyptian border. Seen from the air, the site covers about 3.5 square kilometres, a sprawling tent city of hunger and despair.
Caroline Hawley. But even amid the death and destruction in Gaza, there has been a glimmer of hope in recent days that a new ceasefire deal could be agreed. On Tuesday, the White House National Security spokesman spoke of the potential for an extended pause that would allow more Israeli hostages to be freed. Hamas says it is looking at the proposals. But the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still talking tough.
We will not withdraw the Israel Defense Forces from the Gaza Strip, and we will not release thousands of terrorists. What will happen? Total victory. Absolute victory. No less than that.
Well, given those comments, I asked our Middle East analyst Sebastian Asher if a deal is really getting closer, and if so, what it might look like.
What Netanyahu has said is no different from what he's been saying throughout. This was a speech saying that his government is committed to absolute victory, which has essentially been his mantra since day one, which means total elimination of Hamas. That's politically and militarily. Whether that means now of a complete elimination of Hamas fighters, I mean, that's something which obviously is very unlikely to be accomplished and would take months more of a kind of intensity of bombardment that we've seen in Gaza. In terms of the deal, what we've we've heard about that from various sources is this would be a considerably longer pause in the fighting than the previous one, which lasted a week. This would be potentially at least a month or up to 6 weeks. And it would be a staged release of hostages, perhaps 35 women, children and the elderly in the first batch. And with that, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. And then that would build up as confidence built up. The publicly stated positions, as we heard there from Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas as well, are essentially still totally at odds. What Netanyahu says is it's not going to be a complete withdrawal of the troops and we're not going to release thousands of Palestinian prisoners. What Hamas has said is in order to negotiate, we need a commitment to a total withdrawal. And their bargaining chips, the hostages, are in order to get release that number of prisoners.
Now, Israel wants to eliminate Hamas. One of the ways it's doing that is to try to get rid of its tunnels. And today we learned that it's now flooding those tunnels with seawater. What's the significance of that?
Well, this is confirmation from the IDF. We had reports several weeks ago that they were starting to do this, and this was controversial for a number of reasons, one of which, from the perspective of the hostages and their families, was that it's believed that many of the hostages are down in the tunnels and that it could be another danger to their lives on top of the bombardment, the shooting, Hamas treatment, medical illness, all of that, but also environmentally, that this is seawater that is being put into the tunnels and that could contaminate the groundwater in Gaza in already an appalling situation. But Israel saying that this is just some tunnels and just one of the tools they're using against the network.
Sebastian Usher, our Middle East analyst. President Biden has said he's decided how the US will respond to the drone strike in Jordan on Sunday that killed three American service personnel and injured almost three dozen more. Speaking as he left the White House for an election campaign event, Mr. Biden told reporters that he held Iran responsible for the attack, saying it had supplied the weapons used. Tehran has denied involvement. From Washington, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
Joe Biden was giving little away about the specifics of the decision he's taken, but it's clear that a course of action has been settled on after consultations with military and intelligence chiefs. He's come under pressure from some Republicans to hit Iranian targets directly, but his administration is desperately trying to avoid a wider war in the Middle East. That's not what I'm looking for, he told reporters. Separately, the spokesman for the National Security Council, John Kirby, said that while the US would not telegraph its punches, it was possible there would be a tiered approach with multiple actions over time, aimed, he said, at degrading the capabilities the groups have to launch attacks.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Well, following that attack on US troops in Jordan, the latest edition of the Global Story podcast is looking at Iran's strategy in the Middle East. And you can find that in the usual places where you search for your BBC podcasts. And while we're talking podcasts, we are planning to do a special edition of the Global News podcast to coincide with the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. We'll be joining forces with our friends at Ukrainecast to answer any questions you may have about where the war goes from here. Please email us if there's anything you'd like to know, and if possible, record a voice note so we can play it in that podcast. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet us on X at Global News Pod. Back to Iran now, and for decades there's been simmering tension between the government and Kurdish groups in the west of the country. On Monday, the Iranian authorities hanged four Kurdish activists arrested more than a year ago, accused of collaborating with Israel. A day later, much of the Kurdish region came to a standstill as a result of a general strike as people protested against the killings. People chanting outside the house of one of those who was hanged. Human rights groups have condemned the executions, which took place at a prison outside Tehran. I heard more about the Kurdish anger from the BBC Persian Service correspondent, Ciyar Gol.
This execution of these four young men outraged many in the Kurdish region, which is the beacon of protest against the Islamic Republic of Iran. I have been in contact with some of the family members of those people who have been executed. Their bodies have been still possessed by the government, and they have told the family they will bury them in an unknown location. When a Kurdish political party and a few small parties call for a strike, many, including me, were surprised by the extent of the protest. Also, some of the major Kurdish cities in northwest of Iran entirely shut down. And I think it shows how much people are angry with the government. I could see thousands of people wearing symbols of Kurdish fighters in the mountain walking toward the house of those people who have been executed defiantly. It shows people are not afraid anymore of the regime.
The Iranian authorities say these four executed men were convicted of collaborating with Israel. Are there links between Kurds and Israel? And what do you make of those accusations in this case?
Well, I am sure there are some sympathies between two nations. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. In the past, before the revolution, 1979, there was a collaboration until 1975 between Iranian intelligence service and Mossad by training Iraqi Kurds to fight against Saddam Hussein. But now we don't have any tangible evidence to prove the Kurds in Iran are helping Israeli intelligence service Mossad to carry out assassination or sabotage in Iran.
So what do you think is the real reason that these men have been executed?
If you look at what is happening in Syria in the past few months, numbers of high-ranking Revolutionary Guards Quds Force commanders have been killed by drone attack or airstrike by Israelis. So there is a lot of pressure for Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They project themselves as a power. At this point of time, I believe Iranian government want to send message. We are decisive and we are powerful.
Jihar Gol of the BBC Persian Service. The party of the former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has condemned the 10-year prison sentence he was given on Tuesday. The cricketer-turned-politician was found guilty of leaking classified documents when he was in power. Mr. Khan is already in jail for not declaring details of gifts he received while in office. He has denied the charges and will appeal. The sentence came less than 2 weeks before a general election in which Mr. Khan is barred from standing. In a message on social media, he urged supporters to come out in large numbers to vote for his party. A close aide, Zulfi Bukhari, told the BBC the sentence would only boost Mr. Khan's electoral appeal.
The people of Pakistan are standing with him and they can't seem to subdue his popularity. Even today's decision is only going to make the people come out in higher numbers on February 8th, election day.
Well, Owen Bennett-Jones is a former BBC Pakistan correspondent. He told Nuala McGovern more about this charismatic politician.
He's been the most famous man in Pakistan since he was about 20 years old, and he's 71 now. He was a cricketing hero and has remained in the public eye ever since, a charismatic man, still highly popular, and has a lot of support in the country. After years of campaigning, having left his cricketing career behind him and went into politics, it took him decades to do it, but he did it. But he did it with army support. And then they fell out, the army and Imran, and now he's in jail and they are controlling the situation from GHQ.
So let's talk a little bit more about the military's influence on politics in Pakistan. You talk about the clash, I suppose, between Mr. Khan and the military in short order there.
Yeah, sure. All legal cases like this of the top politicians are basically designed to manipulate the political situation. And the army were very keen on Imran because they thought that he was a charismatic leader who would be a great front man for them. He shared many of their values, having abandoned his playboy days and his love of London and the West. He became vitriolically anti-Western in every speech, Islamist, nationalist, and therefore was in line with many army officers. And it seemed like they would get on famously and that he would be the perfect politician for them to have in the public eye while they did a lot of the business of government. But his ego was too big, his desire for control too great, and they just, in the end, couldn't work together. And it was particularly problematic for the army because he was appealing to exactly the same base as the army, you know, this Islamist nationalist mainstream in Pakistan. So they were fighting over the same constituency, and that made it particularly difficult for the army. In the end, they decided they just couldn't tolerate it, and they got rid of him.
And you do say that he's very popular, but is he also a divisive figure?
Not really. When he was in power, he did have huge support because he was seen as not corrupt. I mean, you've mentioned the case of these gifts that were sold. I know people very close to Imran who say in the old days he did used to do that when he got given something. He's not very materialistic. He doesn't want this sort of stuff, so he'd sell it. But it's nothing like other politicians who have leached hundreds of millions of dollars, which are sitting in Swiss bank accounts. He's not like that. The perception is that compared to the other politicians, he is not corrupt.
And that was Owen Bennett-Jones talking to Nuala McGovern. Now, it's an all too annoying phenomenon of the summer. Open a window at night and insects swarm in, buzzing crazily around the nearest light source. Well, now scientists think they have found out why, as they revealed in the journal Nature Communications. Terry Egan has this report.
It's long been known that artificial light attracts flying insects. There are even records from the Roman Empire describing the use of light to trap them. The reason, though, has never really been clear. Now, though, researchers have used high-speed infrared cameras under a range of light conditions to look at what's happening. Insects can't measure gravity while they're flying, so they solve the dilemma by using the direction of light. With natural light, that's no problem. The sky is above them, and they can orientate themselves using the horizon. But when it comes to artificial light, say the scientists, insects confuse that light with up. It means they're continually correcting the course of their flight, so their backs face towards the light, which they think is up there somewhere, and their fronts towards where they think gravity is. But because they're wrong about all of that, the imbalance leads them into all sorts of weird flight paths. It's why, to us, the insects seem so erratic, even, you might say, a bit light-headed. It's also why, as we buzz about our own business, they can be so annoying to us humans.
That report by Terry Egan. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
If I had to pick between law and music, I really hope my mom doesn't hear this, but I'll pick music today, tomorrow, the day after.
The young Sierra Leonean hoping to put her music on the global map. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has suffered a big setback after Parliament rejected an amnesty bill designed to protect some Catalan separatist politicians. Mr. Sanchez needs their support after failing to win a majority in last year's election. But the party of the former Catalan president, Carles Puigdemont, actually voted against the bill, saying it didn't go far enough. For more on what it means for the Prime Minister, I spoke to our correspondent Guy Hedgeco in Madrid.
His government will survive for the moment, I think, and certainly, you know, for the next few weeks. I don't think people are going to be talking about it collapsing. But this was a big blow for him because he staked so much political capital on this amnesty. He needs the amnesty to be successful in order to maintain the support of Catalan nationalist parties. For the moment, the amnesty has not been able to go through Congress, so that's obviously a problem for him. The question now is whether he can get the amnesty bill revised enough to the liking of Carles Puigdemont and other Catalan nationalists so that it can get the support in a few weeks' time to go through Congress and therefore be approved and implemented.
Yeah, because it's opposed from both sides, both those Catalans and the right-wingers who really hate it.
Yeah, this was quite a weird turn of events because we had the right-wing opposition, conservatives and the far right, who've frequently expressed opposition to the amnesty, saying it's unconstitutional. They voted against it, but so too did the Catalan nationalists of Mr. Puigdemont's party. His reasons obviously were very different. He felt it just wasn't good enough, the law, in terms of protecting him and others from investigations into alleged terrorism he's been linked to by a judicial investigation. So he felt it wasn't the bulletproof enough to go through and then resist any legal challenges in the future.
And briefly, what do the public make of it?
Well, they're very divided on this. It's an extremely controversial bill. I think that the political situation reflects how Spaniards feel. Generally speaking, people on the right tend to be more opposed to it. People on the left tend to be more supportive of the amnesty. Up in Catalonia, it has more support, but it is very divisive.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Cholera cases have been on the rise worldwide, and more than half the countries affected are in Africa. Zambia is battling its worst outbreak ever. Since October, more than 550 people have died from the preventable and treatable disease. Now the government has launched a mass vaccination campaign in the hope of vastly reducing the number of cases. The BBC's Kennedy Gondwe has been finding out how it's going.
It's a sunny day at Lusaka's United Church of Zambia congregation in George Township. A choir marks the beginning of a mass vaccination campaign against cholera. Children and adults line up to receive their dose. One of them is Sophia Piri.
I got the vaccine because a lot of people in my community were hiding that they were sick. People would have stomach sickness and diarrhea, but treat it with traditional medicine.
Zambia is battling its worst ever outbreak of cholera. Authorities are rushing to provide vaccination to more than 1.5 million people, but supplies are running low. Sylvia Masebo is a minister of health in Zambia.
The manufacturers have not really been manufacturing, so the vaccines are not easily available. We are also making further orders. Hopefully we should be able to get some more in the shortest period of time.
Zambian authorities have recorded more than 15,000 cholera infections since October, the highest number the country has ever recorded. At the beginning of this year, as cases were rising quickly, a businessman from Lusaka, Andrew Kazadi, got a call from the local clinic. His 26-year-old nephew, Charles, was ill with cholera.
We got a call informing us he wasn't feeling well. Then, the following day, the clinic told us he was okay, that he was chatty. A day later, I found out that he had died.
More than 550 people have died so far in Zambia. Authorities have closed schools and put tight regulations around the carrying out of funerals to contain the spread.
We had been told to look for a coffin so he could be buried. But if we delay, then they'll bury him, just like that. We are really grieving as a family.
Water pumps drawing water from shallow wells are a common sight in Lusaka's townships. But the vicinity of pit latrines can contaminate the water and spread cholera. And to make matters worse, a heavy rainy season has brought floods to many areas of Lusaka. Dr. Gabriel Pollen is a national coordinator of Zambia's Disaster Management Unit.
So what the rain does is that it complicates the living conditions of households that are prone to flooding. And because these households are getting their source of water from shallow wells, but at the same time we see that there are some pit latrines that they use that are also getting flooded. It's a continuous mixing of fecal matter and the water.
Insecurity and lack of access to clean water are fanning the spread of cholera globally. According to the WHO, more than 30 countries reported outbreaks last year. Half of them are in Africa. Back in Zambia, the government is planning long-term measures to ensure an outbreak like this doesn't happen again.
Long-term is to resettle some of these people who are in areas that cannot be upgraded. For others, it's upgrading, opening new roads and providing all the necessary amenities like sanitation and good water supply.
But without a clear deadline in place, people living in cholera-prone areas will have to manage the risk by themselves.
Kennedy Gondwe with that report. Universities may battle over funding or getting the best students, even academic league tables. But a dispute between two colleges in the Thai capital Bangkok has turned violent with deadly consequences. I heard more from our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton.
On Friday, a student at the Pattimwon Institute of Technology was stabbed to death after a quite violent brawl. And that's led Thailand's education ministry to come out to say that students from a rival school, that's the Utentawai campus at Ranjamagala University, that school won't be allowed to admit any new students. They're also hastening up the school's relocation to another part of Thailand altogether. These two schools have been at war for quite some time. They're located in the exact same neighborhood in Bangkok. And so that's why the Ministry of Education is really hastening the relocation of one school in an effort to stop this ongoing feud.
I mean, it seems extraordinary that a rivalry between two universities could erupt into violence.
I know, you would think that, but this rivalry is incredibly intense, has caused many deaths and injuries over the years. So even if we just go back to November, another student from the Utentawai campus was killed after a brawl between gangs from the two schools. A stray bullet also killed a teacher who didn't even teach at either school, just happened to be bypassing. There was such an uproar against the stray bullet death of this teacher that the national police chief of Thailand in December had a big press conference and said that he believed that criminal gangs were fueling this rivalry at both schools. He thought the only way to stop this rivalry is to push ahead with the relocation of one of the schools.
Do we know what sparked the rivalry, or is it just these gangs that have infiltrated?
A lot of people are saying that this rivalry is partly because these schools are so similar. They teach similar programs in construction, technology, mechanics. They're located in the same neighborhood. And so I think to differentiate themselves, they started this rivalry. And over time, it's just become more and more intense. So many people are aware of this rivalry in Thailand. But I think at this point, many people are just fed up with it. They're saying, just as the Ministry of Education said, that the relocation of one of these schools can't come soon enough.
Celia Hatton, our Asia-Pacific editor. Next, to a legendary scene from a Russian film made nearly a century ago. That is the 1925 silent movie Battleship Potemkin, portraying citizens tumbling down a huge flight of steps as Cossacks shoot at them in Odessa, in the then Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Made by Sergei Eisenstein, it was one of the most famous productions of Russia's main film studio, Mosfilm. It is now celebrating its 100th anniversary. And to tell us more, I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Based in Moscow, it's seen a string of films. I mean, at one time, Ollie, it was producing more than 50 feature films a year, and they said it's made more than 2,000 feature films in its 100-year history. So truly colossal output. The first film was a film called On Wings High. That film celebrated the heroism of Soviet pilots. Then it went on in the 30s to become the Soviet equivalent of Hollywood, doing propaganda films and obviously patriotic films during the Second World War. Fell on hard times in the late 80s and 90s when state funding was withdrawn, but it managed to survive that and come back. And anyone who is anyone in Soviet or Russian film, it seems, has worked there. You've played Battleship Potemkin there from Sergei Eisenstein, often cited as one of the best films of all time. At its premiere, there was a scene where the sailors raise a red flag, and each frame of that was hand-tinted red, which was a revolutionary act in itself. So much so that the film was actually banned in a number of Western countries. But other directors, Sergei Bondarchuk, for example, did a seven-hour truly epic War and Peace there in the 60s. That was the first Soviet film to win the Best Foreign Film in the Oscars. And it was also cited as the most expensive film ever made, with huge battle scenes so big that it actually had its own special cavalry regiment formed for the film that wasn't disbanded until the 2000s. Andrei Tarkovsky, who did another great film classic, Andrei Rublev, about the 15th century icon painter, and Solaris, a 1972 science fiction film, which had international success. Here's the film's English language trailer.
Let us take you with us to Solaris, planet of mystery, embodiment of man's latent conflict with the unknown.
Is Mosfilm still making films now?
It's still very successful. It's modernised considerably since the 1990s, and it's producing a large amount of output, partly because of the war in Ukraine. Basically, with Western filmmakers not releasing films in Russia, there's a huge demand for domestic output.
Danny Eberhardt on 100 years of Mosfilm. Finally, to the story of a rising musical star in Sierra Leone. Boy, who is not a boy but a young woman, has just been named as Sierra Leone's Best Female Musician of 2023. Her song, Credit Alert, made the charts in several countries. She spoke to the BBC about her ambition to bring the music of Sierra Leone to the world stage.
Oh, best, today I know they sleep now. Oh, I don't get credit alert. I don't get credit alert.
Hey, what's up? This is Boy, aka your boyfriend, from Sierra Leone, West Africa. I'm 18 years old. I was born in Freetown. I was singing since I was six, and then I started making music professionally about 2 years ago.
Nobody could tell me.
The first time I was in a studio or recorded a song, it was really magical. It was like a mix of emotions. I was feeling nervous, very nervous, because I had no experience whatsoever with the booth, with mics, with the beats, with anything at all. I was just the dumbest in the room. And I was just trying my really best to impress everyone. But I was so excited at the same time, because I kind of felt like, oh, I belong here. Fun facts about me. I study law and I do music. I do not recommend this to anyone. It's really hard because both of them are like full-time careers that I have to really give my all to. And with how life is going, gratefully, thank God, people actually know who I am. So when I go to university, you would have people come up to you to take pictures and stuff like that. I like that. Don't stop, guys. But it's really hectic sometimes, but I'm making it work. If I had to pick between law and music, I really hope my mom doesn't hear this, but I'll pick music. I'll pick music today, tomorrow, the day after, next year, the next century, my next birthday. I really love doing law too, but not just as much as I like doing music.
I call your phone, cause I want to know what's going on.
My first song that I recorded ever in my life was called Not Enough. The song is basically about a couple. So they're dating and she feels like she's not... Okay, that's literally the name of the song, but she's not enough for the person she's dating, her partner. And even though she tries every single thing in the world to make herself seem good enough for them, they just don't appreciate it. I'm not enough for you. I'm not enough for you. To be quite honest, I was kind of shocked. I was like, wait, people are going to be like, what do you know about stuff like this? I'm in a family of mostly sisters, and growing up with a lot of other women, you're going to hear a lot about their relationship problems, even if you like it or not.
It's Cammy, baby.
The Sierra Leonean music scene is absolutely beautiful, in my opinion. We have really good music coming from here. The only sad part is it doesn't go out of here. And that's really sad to me, because it would be great if people could hear music made in and from Sierra Leone. I really hope it would happen through me and my music and performances and stuff like that. Not that I don't want anyone else to do it. Come on now. I'm supportive to everyone.
Boy, a new star from Sierra Leone. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This one was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.